It's Monday, August 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, the world reacts to a lower-valued Chinese currency as markets adjust this week.
Having a bigger presence there allows us to engage with foreign diplomatic missions in different parts of Cuban civil society on the island.
With embassies reopened, what's ahead for the United States and Cuba? Also ahead, a new phenom is exciting golf fans, the music great you probably have never heard of. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Last week, China devalued its currency, and that triggered concerns of an international currency war and raised some fresh questions about the health of the world's second largest economy. The move had effects on global markets, and for three consecutive days, the renminbi's value was intentionally lowered. It fell more than 3% before it was raised slightly by week's end. Bank officials said the currency was close to trading at market level and dismissed as complete nonsense rumors that Beijing was ready to let the currency's value fall as much as 10%. VOA senior economic correspondent Jim Randall is with me. Jim, this is the way China seems to manage its currency exchange. What's happening here and what might we expect this week?
There's two points of view. One is that China and its friends say China is making the currency exchange more closer to market forces, and that's true. They take into account yesterday's close, for example, and it is a little more driven by the market, which the United States and the IMF and other people have been urging them to do for a long time. It's a little closer. At the same time, whenever any country, China or any other nation, when their currency becomes weaker, cheaper, products produced in that country or our country or anybody else's country become less expensive on global markets. That gives them a price advantage. And so there's a reason to try to have a weak currency. There are also reasons not to. It hurts you in other ways. Under the profound economic rule, meaning there's no such thing as a free lunch. But in this case, China's many critics say they're just doing it to boost their exports. I think both actually are true, that China is moving in a slightly more market-oriented direction in dealing with their currency, and this move came shortly after some unhappy news for China about their exports, and they're not going nearly as well as they had hoped, and the economy is still very dependent on exports, even though they've been trying very diligently to try to have a more consumption-oriented economy and to have it move more towards services and so forth. That hasn't happened yet.
You know, robust trade has built the Chinese economy to what it is over the past many years, but people are buying differently now than they used to. Countries are not buying perhaps as many Chinese goods as they are from other countries.
Well, one of the things that's happened is that China's economy is maturing, as all of everybody's economy does gradually. What was once seen as a more or less inexhaustible supply of labor has become finite. And workers with appropriate skills are demanding higher pay, and they're getting it in some cases. And so that's raising China's production costs, which means some of the production that was offshored from the United States or from other advanced nations and ended up in China is now moving past China and going other places. And just costs have gone up a bit. So their exports aren't quite as competitive as they once were.
Similar things happened to Japan in the 1970s, and the production shifted largely to Korea. Now Korea's economy has matured as well. Does China have a lot to learn from its neighbors and what happened to their economies over the past decades?
Well, certainly. And they're it's a pretty astute group of people. I had the privilege of living there for a few years, and I was impressed. A country with enormous potential, enormous problems, and a whole lot of very smart people trying very hard to figure things out, sometimes successfully, sometimes not. But I think you would be foolish to bet against China.
a lot of people would just on the surface immediately say, oh, this is manipulation and that sort of thing. But it goes beyond that, as you mentioned.
Every time I do a story, I discover that the economy is kind of like a Rubik's Cube on steroids. I mean, you change this part and the whole other end of it turns purple or something. And that's certainly true in this case.
Well, certainly all of the colors are in alignment whenever we speak with Jim Randall. Thank you so much, Jim, for your time and thoughts.
My pleasure.
Well, the Chinese currency is still attracting lots of attention from social media. Michael Lippin is here to tell us more. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Jim. Well, I can tell you that the commentary we've been seeing about the yuan on Twitter is mostly about two issues. Why exactly the Chinese central bank allowed the yuan to weaken significantly for 3 days in a row, and what happens next for the currency. So let me tell you first about the reasons why people think China devalued the yuan. A tweet on that topic by Bloomberg TV is getting noticed. Mm. A short time ago, it tweeted a link to a report by Bloomberg journalist Enda Curran, who writes that the motivation for China's currency shift is a source of debate among economists. Curran writes that one motive for China to let the market steer the yuan's value is a bid to have the currency accepted by the International Monetary Fund into its basket of reserve currencies. Now, that basket contains the dollar, the euro, the Japanese yen, and the British pound, and joining that club would boost China's global stature. Curran also writes that by weakening the currency and making Chinese products cheaper in overseas markets, China hopes that its exports will get a boost and stimulate its overall economy. But he says that a weaker currency won't solve everything because China's recent fall in exports is at least partly due to weak consumer demand in key Chinese markets like Europe.
Mm. Well, what have you found on Twitter regarding the next steps for the yuan?
Well, I've seen that some people are tweeting a link to a Reuters report published today featuring comments from the Chinese central bank's chief economist, Ma Jun. Now, in that story, Reuters reports that it got an email from Ma in which he says that the yuan's drop last week and its increased flexibility will sharply reduce the possibility of similar adjustments in the future. Ma also is quoted as saying that in the near term, he expects two-way volatility in the yuan's value. So that means not just depreciation, mm-hmm. but also appreciation. Now, these kinds of statements from Chinese officials are a response to concerns that China's move to weaken its currency could prompt its neighbors to do the same so that they also can make their exports cheaper overseas. And that scenario is commonly referred to as a currency war. Jim?
Wow. Well, Michael, thank you so much. You can follow him at Michael_Lippin. Michael Lippin can find anything interesting on social media. Thank you so much. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
This is VOA's International Edition. On Friday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was in Havana to preside at a ceremony raising the U.S. flag at the American Embassy, reopened in a ceremony that confirmed the two nations' re-engagement after more than a half century. VOA's Jeffrey Young spoke with Tomas Bilbao, the executive director of the Cuba Study Group here in Washington, about the best way for the United States to communicate and engage the Cuban government on issues still contentious between the two nations.
Well, two things really come to mind. One is, first of all, that the opening of the embassy isn't just an avenue, which it is, to improve our presence and our leverage inside Cuba and create avenues of cooperation with the Cuban government on bilateral issues such as drug interdiction, environmental disaster mitigation and other things, but also as a way to engage with the Cuban people. Having a bigger presence there allows us to engage with foreign diplomatic missions and different parts of Cuban civil society on the island.
The American Embassy in countries all over the world actively engages with the local population, showing them American values, various things go on. And how is this going to work out in Cuba? Because for so many years, this was wrong, and now all of a sudden it's okay. How do we cross that divide?
I think it's an important signal. Once the Cuban government has established normal diplomatic relations with the U.S. embassy on the ground in their country, it becomes more difficult to justify why they would oppose the presence of average citizens visiting our embassy and taking advantage of peaceful and educational opportunities that exist there. So I think that that's helpful. I suppose that the U.S. government will continue to do a lot of those efforts, and it'll look a lot like what our embassies in Russia and other places look like. We're sure those are perhaps more challenging environments, but nonetheless our top-rate diplomats do a great job of engaging with the population and providing support that represent and U.S. values abroad.
You brought up drug interdiction as one way that the U.S. and Cuba could cooperate. Another one is hurricanes. Obviously, we're getting into hurricane season, and hurricanes are of major concern to both countries. What do you think of the idea of using that as a stepping stone towards better engagement with the Cuban government?
That's one clear area in which we can cooperate, and which is a natural area for us to do so. In fact, the U.S. government has already established a number of bilateral discussions with Cuba on several topics, drug interdiction being one, as I mentioned before, environmental cooperation in response to oil spills being another. So that certainly is one that there are things that we can learn from the Cuban government, and certainly there's a lot that they can benefit from our technology and cooperation. Civil society can also play an important role, like the Cuba Study Group did in the response to hurricanes in the past, where we helped raise $500,000 and bought roofing material to send to affected people on the island. So I think that in big picture wise, we should look at not just ways the U.S. government and Cuba can cooperate, but the way the U.S. civil society and Cuban civil society can do so as well.
Tomas Bilbao speaking with VOA's Jeffrey Young about U.S.-Cuba relations. Well, the professional golf season is now winding down with the last of its four major tournaments, the PGA Championship, which this year was being held at Whistling Straits in Kohler, Wisconsin. Among the leaders in the final day, Jordan Spieth. He's a rising American star who won the Masters and the U.S. Open this year. I'm with sports guru Park Brewer. Park, Spieth is making history even without winning the PGA Championship. He came tantalizingly close to capturing the British Open a few weeks ago, and of course, no one has ever won all four of golf's majors in a single year.
Never done before, and actually in winning three in one year like that, the first three had only been done twice before.
Mm-hmm.
And
Ben Hogan in 53 and Tiger Woods in 2000.
Exactly.
Yeah,
it would have been quite an achievement, and I know a lot of people were pulling for him, and as you say, Jim, it was so close. And but just to be in contention even after winning those first two, golf is such a difficult game, and certainly the professionals make it look so easy. Mm-hmm. I know you and I have been out on the golf course before, and they just make it look too easy. You think you could go out and do something similar, but even looking at the course this week, the PGA Championship in Wisconsin, where it's along Lake Michigan, and you got the breezes, and you've got some cliffs there that go down, it's tough. You got to be so accurate. And but these guys have been taming the course this mm-hmm. week. It's just incredible the kinds of scores these professionals have been shooting, both Jordan Spieth and Jason Day, the two guys in contention on the last day. And it's interesting to listen to the golf commentators, how they've been so impressed, how so many of the golfers have shot so well under par at this tournament these 4 days.
I know we were all amazed watching Tiger Woods come along out of junior golf and into the pro ranks, and the things that he accomplished, just absolutely amazing. And, you know, now we've seen a couple more phenoms come out, Rory McIlroy for one, and now Spieth.
Exactly, and of course you mentioned Rory McIlroy, and he of course missed the British Open because he injured his ankle playing pickup soccer on July 4th. So there was a big question on how well he could play after that at the PGA, and he's shown a little bit of rust, no doubt about it, not in contention. Then, of course, Tiger Woods, just another catastrophe for him. He's not been playing well at all, did not make the cut at the PGA Championship, and this just seems to be the kind of game that he has these days, which is really, Jim, no game at all. It's just really quite shocking. But as you say, we've got these up-and-coming young guys like Rory McIlroy, Jordan Spieth, and Jason Day from Australia. You know, it's great to see them battle, and Jason has come so close. He's been second in three majors, but he's finished in the top 10 in like 9 of the last 10 majors. So he would be a worthy champion if he ends up taking this one.
Well, like so many other sports that we have covered, golf is one that tends to regenerate over time, and always fun to watch the up-and-comers, and always fun to speak with Park Brewer about sports. Park, thank you so much.
All right, Jim, my pleasure.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Behind every great song is a songwriter. Through the decades, the most successful have been very well heard, but have lived in relative obscurity. David Byrd likes to follow music and entertainment for International Edition. He joins Ray McDonald in the studio to talk about the latest superstar you likely have never heard of.
You know his work, but you might not know his name. Max Martin has put the pen to paper and written a slew of number ones. Ray, this guy's got things that he's written. Taylor Swift's Bad Blood. He's also written the current number one song, right?
Can't Feel My Face by The Weeknd. I love talking about this guy because he's such a phenomenon and nobody outside the music industry knows him. Max Martin from Sweden. Can't Feel My Face is his 21st number one single on the Hot 100 as a songwriter. It's his 19th as a producer. Only Lennon and McCartney top him in the songwriter category. And he is second as a producer behind George Martin, who did the Beatles.
'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. You know it used to be mad love. So take a look what you've done. 'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. Hey, now we got problems. And I don't think we can solve them. You made a really deep cut. And baby, now we got bad blood. Hey.
So what other songs has he done that our audience knows about, besides Bad Blood and Can't Feel My Face?
Well, Max Martin started his run of number ones here in the States back in 1999 with Baby One More Time. And he's really caught fire since 2008. 17 of his 19 chart-topping production hits have happened in the past 7 years. And as I say, Can't Feel My Face is his second number one hit of 2015, following Bad Blood.
Does he write these solo, or does he collaborate with people, or both?
He generally collaborates with people. The Weeknd actively collaborated in writing Can't Feel My Face. Generally, Max Martin will do the bulk of the songwriting for his clients, but The Weeknd really insisted on having a bigger say.
Now, is he lyrics and music, or just lyrics, or what?
Well, generally it's lyrics and music, and he started out in Sweden's public music education programs when he was a boy, and he has gone out of his way to thank them for his success. And that's worth noting because in many parts of the United States, these public music programs are either gone or endangered.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, music and arts and, sadly, sports sometimes are the first couple of things to go away.
That's exactly right.
When the emphasis is on what they call STEM, like science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and getting test scores. But creative arts sometimes is the first thing to suffer. And yet guys like this get their whole life out of a public education. Well, all right, if you have any comments about Max Martin, about some of the tunes he's written, or anything else you hear on our program, you can send us a tweet. We're at VOA underscore IE. You can also send Ray a tweet at a couple of places. One, at Ray on the Hits, and that's his personal account. And you can also send it to at VOA underscore music. And if you want to hear Ray count down the top 20 or the top 5 songs every week, log on to www.voanews.com.
You've been listening to International Edition, and thanks, Dave, for throwing out all those Twitter accounts that you can follow us on. Also, check us out on Facebook. VOA Asia is our Facebook page, and you can email us at voaasia@voanews.com. Of course, we're always on the web at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Zina Bobdell-Rockman. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month, the United States and Laos celebrate 60 years of diplomatic relations, ties that commenced soon after Laos declared its independence in 1954. Despite relations being downgraded during the wars in Indochina, the two countries never cut their lines of communication. And with the full restoration in 1992 of U.S.-Lao diplomatic relations, and despite different political systems, the United States and Laos have cooperated in a number of important areas of common interest. These include counter-narcotics, strengthening the regulatory framework and trade capacity of Laos, HIV/AIDS prevention and treatment, improving health care and child nutrition, and a commitment to ensuring a prosperous and sustainable future for the Mekong subregion. But going as far back as 1975, the initial focus of the bilateral relationship was clearing unexploded ordnance from the Vietnam War. The effort continues to this day. Just over the past 20 years, the United States has invested more than $80 million in supporting Laos to safely clear these explosive remnants of war. Today, although Laos is still governed by a one-party communist regime, its economy is essentially a free market system, which took root in 1986 with the introduction of significant economic reforms. Thus, the main goal of the United States is to assist Laos to meet its development goals, improve governance and the rule of law, and increase its capacity to integrate fully within the Association for Southeast Asian Nations and the global economy. Secretary of State John Kerry recently said, "The partnership between the United States and Laos also strengthens the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. I want to reaffirm the United States' strong commitment to supporting Laos as it assumes the chairmanship of ASEAN in 2016. As we commemorate 6 decades of understanding and collaboration, we look forward to even deeper ties between our two countries as we build a peaceful and prosperous future."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.